From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk about the life and the songs of Irving Berlin with Berlin's biographer, Lawrence Berggren. Also today, we meet artist David Voinarovich, one of the artists at the center of the controversy over federal funding of the arts. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Nocturnes by Irish composer John Field. And book critic John Leonard reviews journalist Timothy Garton Ash's account of the democracy movement in Eastern Europe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today reversed his no new taxes pledge and conceded that what he called tax revenue increases might be needed in order to significantly reduce the federal budget deficit. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The White House refused to define what Mr. Bush meant by tax revenue increases, but to Democrats the message was clear enough. The president has agreed to higher taxes. To Republicans, the president's statement means loss of a major campaign issue. No longer will they be able to claim their president and party resisted Democratic efforts to raise taxes. House Speaker Thomas Foley.
Someone who is complaining about taxes being raised in the budget summit will have to complain against both parties and the president, if they wish to make that kind of complaint. But we're not going to go into these thinking that that's going to be the result.
Talks between congressional leaders and the White House to reduce the deficit resume tomorrow. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Lithuania's prime minister asked the republic's parliament today to freeze its declaration of independence. Kazimiera Prunskynia said that Soviet President Gorbachev has offered to lift the 9-week-old economic embargo against Lithuania if the declaration is suspended. She argued that separation from the Soviet Union would be impossible without a compromise with the Kremlin. The prime minister said that Gorbachev has agreed to begin negotiations that will discuss a different status for Lithuania, including the possibility of an independent state. One of Israel's leading human rights organizations has accused the police of using violence against young people being interrogated for alleged security offenses. According to a report published by the group, conditions in one of Jerusalem's main detention centers fall short of the most basic standards. The BBC's Paul Adams reports from Jerusalem.
The report says that almost every teenager interviewed for the survey spoke of being punched, kicked, and beaten with clubs and iron bars. Violence, says the report, is not confined to interrogation, but has become the norm during detention. The main target of B'Tselem's criticism is the feared Russian compound, where relatives gather daily hoping for news of arrested family members. According to the report, conditions there do not meet what it calls even the most minimal requirements of humane imprisonment. Some detainees spoke of being held for days on end in tiny, stench-filled cells, often in severely overcrowded conditions. They described two particularly grim cells, one nicknamed the closet, where prisoners could stand but not move, and the other called the grave, a filthy room no bigger than a box, with space only to sit bent over.
The BBC's Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Stock prices fell slightly today on Wall Street as the market posted its third straight loss. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 3 points to close at 2,842.33. Volume was 141 million shares. This is NPR News. The Louisiana Senate began debate today on an anti-abortion law that aims its toughest penalties at doctors who perform the procedure. The bill passed by the House last week would send doctors who perform abortions to prison for 10 years of hard labor. The House measure makes no exceptions for cases involving rape and incest and allows abortions only to save the life of the mother. Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer has said he'll veto the bill if it doesn't include exceptions for rape and incest. That's expected to be the major focus of the Senate debate. Research today indicates that ocean life could be dramatically hurt as man-made chemicals chip away at the Earth's protective ozone layer. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
The ozone layer miles above the Earth is crucial to life. It filters out harmful ultraviolet rays from the sun. And that ozone layer is slowly disintegrating because of human chemicals like CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, used in refrigerators. In today's study, researchers tried to simulate how this ozone loss would affect the oceans. They collected seawater throughout the southern Pacific and exposed it to extra ultraviolet rays. The growth of microscopic plankton dropped. The researchers calculate plankton might decline by as much as a third if today's rate of ozone loss continues. Since plankton is at the bottom of the food chain, fish and other ocean life would be hurt too. But an international environmental meeting in London is now considering banning most ozone-destroying chemicals by the end of the decade, a move likely to be adopted in the next few days, and one scientists say should avert an ozone catastrophe. This is Michael Scholar in San Francisco.
Police in Rochester, New York, say that gunmen got away with more than $10 million in an armored car robbery early this morning. The robbery reportedly took place in a suburban neighborhood while the truck driver and another employee had stopped at a convenience store for sandwiches. Gunmen overpowered the two and forced them to drive to a more rural location. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Irving Berlin wrote so many contagious songs that early on in his career, there were rumors that his songs were ghostwritten by black boys. Berlin wrote catchy songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band, Puttin' on the Ritz, and I Love a Piano, anthems like God Bless America, White Christmas, and Easter Parade, ballads like How Deep is the Ocean and What'll I Do, waltzes like Always, cheerful songs like Isn't It a Lovely Day, and brooding songs like Let's Face the Music and Dance. My guest Lawrence Berggren started a biography of Berlin a couple of years before Berlin died in 1989 at the age of 101. He had become a recluse, estranged from family and friends. It had been 30 years since he spoke to the press. He wouldn't authorize Berggren's biography or grant him an interview, but Berggren did speak to over 200 of Berlin's friends and colleagues. Berggren is also the author of a biography of James Agee. The music industry was very different when Irving Berlin started writing songs at the beginning of the century. I asked Berggren what the place of the songwriter was then.
Well, the songwriter was far more important than he is today. There was Tin Pan Alley. That was on West 28th Street in Manhattan. There was no Hollywood. There was no radio. There were no phonographs or only very primitive home recording devices. So the songwriter and sheet music and music publishing was all of those popular entertainment industries rolled up into one. Tin Pan Alley was originally intended to become the province of immigrant groups arriving in New York, first the Irish and later on the Eastern European Jews, of whom Irving Berlin was one. Of course, his real name was Israel Berlin. He was the son of a cantor and had come over to this country when he was five. So to become a songwriter was instantly to place yourself in the mainstream of American popular culture.
Okay, so these were the days before radio, before records.
Right.
There was sheet music. How were songs sold?
Songs were sold in department stores, such as Woolworth's especially, and other big chains. They were sold in music stores. The home entertainment center wasn't a television or a radio. It was the piano. Getting a piano was a great big event, and composers inevitably composed their songs to be performed on the piano. And it meant that it was a much more participatory form of popular entertainment. Today, we're used to being completely passive, to listening. But if you wanted to have popular entertainment in your home at that time, someone had to play the piano at least a little bit, and someone had to sing along.
Now, Irving Berlin got his start as a song plugger. What did that mean?
Well, what that meant was he plugged other people's songs. He worked in vaudeville theaters, and when it was time for a song to come around, he would stand up in the crowd and, as if spontaneously, although he wasn't fooling anybody, he would sing out the chorus and try and get the audience to sing along with him. It was sort of the equivalent of an opera claque.
And this would make the song seem really contagious if people would want to run out and buy the sheet music.
It was like being a cheerleader, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, songs were usually owned by the publisher at that time, but when Irving Berlin started writing songs, he eventually started publishing them himself. He must have been very savvy about this.
He was always a very savvy and very careful businessman. This was part of the reason for his success. It wasn't just musical genius. There were a few songwriters, such as Harry Von Tilzer, who was an early mentor of his, who made the leap from being a humble songwriter to being a publisher, an entrepreneur, and they made far more as a publisher than they ever did as a songwriter, just getting a pittance. Berlin was keenly aware of the example of Stephen Foster, whom he considered the great American songwriter, who died virtually penniless. And Berlin was determined not to repeat that example in his own life. So as soon as he was able to, he started his own music publishing company to control his copyrights and royalties and to publish his own songs. He also published songs by other songwriters as well, and what was then known as race music or black music. There was a special division for that.
My guest is Lawrence Berggren, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin. Let's get to one of Berlin's songs. This is the song that established him. It's the first song that was a hit, and it was called My Wife's Gone to the Country. Would you like to say something about this song?
Berlin had great affection for this song because it was his first big hit. It was even before, it was a year before Alexander's Ragtime Band in 1910. And the idea came to him when he walked into a barber shop one night and he heard a friend of his exclaiming with delight that his wife had gone away to the country for the summer, leaving him alone to frolic in the city by himself. Berlin thought this was a great idea for a chorus, My Wife's Gone to the Country, and wrote the song. And it was so popular that a newspaper asked him to write some extra verses for it, which presumably probably don't appear on your recording. He went and wrote 200 extra. Just to give an idea of the fertility of his mind and the rapidity of his the way he worked. He was a very hard worker.
Well, we've got a 1910 recording of My Wife's Gone to the Country featuring Harry Carlton and his orchestra.
I just can't stand the heat. Please send me to the country, dear, I know it would be a treat. Next day his wife and family were seated on a train, and when the train had started, Brownie shouted this refrain: My wife's gone to the country, hurrah, hurrah. She thought it best I need a rest, that's why she went away. She took the children with her, hurrah, hurrah. I don't care what becomes of me, my wife's gone away. My wife's gone to the country. Oh, I am going to enjoy myself.
Lawrence Berggren, why do you think that was such a hit?
Well, I think it struck a nerve. It had a risque overtone to it, and many men could relate to it instantly. It was comic, and it was a novelty song. It was published just before the summer was coming up in the spring, and people went out and got it, and it became a hit song for the summer of 1910.
Just to give a sense of the money, this was before Irving Berlin was publishing his own songs, and you say he made $6,000 from this song.
That's right.
And his publisher made $30,000.
That's right. He was earning just a couple of cents per copy himself, and when he realized how much his publisher was making, he decided he had to become a publisher himself eventually.
Now, Irving Berlin really knew how to tie into the times, and a great early example of that is how he tied into the ragtime craze.
Yes, of course, ragtime had peaked slightly before he came along, and it was mainly black musicians. There were a few white ragtime artists as well. The craze was dying out, and then he revived it by bringing it into the mainstream and adapting it to a Tin Pan Alley formula. Of course, one of the peculiar things about Alexander's Ragtime Band is that it's not a ragtime song. It's not written in ragtime. There's only a little bit of ragtime in it. What made the song sell was using that buzzword, ragtime, in the title. It's actually a march.
Well, you say Alexander's Ragtime Band was really a march. Now, I'd like to play a kind of very march-like version of it, recorded in 1911, a year after the song was written. And then let's contrast that to another version sung by Bessie Smith.
Come on in here, Alexander, the ragtime band.
That's Bessie Smith, and before that we heard the Victor Military Band. I think that really gives a nice sense of how flexible his songs were.
That Bessie Smith, she always sends chills up and down my spine. She's fabulous. Of course, he wrote that song first as an instrumental, and it flopped. And he shelved it for a while, and he wrote some lyrics for it and tried it again, and then it caught on, not in New York where most of these songs did, but in Chicago where Emma Karras sang it, and it worked its way back east gradually.
Lawrence Berggren is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Talking about the life of Irving Berlin with Lawrence Berggren, who's written a new biography called As Thousands Cheer. Well, we were talking about a time before radio, when Berlin was writing songs. What was the effect of radio and the rise in the popularity of recordings on his career?
Well, it helped him, but he dreaded its arrival. He was always very conservative in his approach. He felt that radio would eat up his catalog and wear out his songs. He preferred the slower distribution method of sheet music. But what happened in his case was he wrote what was then called sob songs, such as All Alone, and these were picked up by the radio and they became hugely popular, which sparked sheet music sales and which sparked early recordings as well. So he benefited from a triple play. But some of his concern came to pass for other songwriters or other parts of his business.
Berlin started writing for movies, and you say this was at a time when Tin Pan Alley basically sold out to the Hollywood studios. The studio actually bought a lot of the music publishing companies?
That's right. Well, it was the Depression coming, and what happened was many of the Tin Pan Alley publishers, which had grown very quickly during the teens and 20s, found themselves overextended, short of cash. It's a familiar story. And the Hollywood studios, which were then just beginning to blossom, came along. And, of course, they needed music for the talkies. And they began buying first the songs, then they decided to buy the companies as well. Almost all of them were bought up. Tin Pan Alley became an adjunct of Hollywood, and West 28th Street was quiet. There was only one major music publisher who was a holdout. That was Irving Berlin, Inc.
Why did he hold out?
That was the strength of Berlin's character. He wanted to stand alone. He wanted control over his musical destiny and over himself. He had nothing else he could rely on. He was used to relying on his own wits to survive. And he felt if he could only ride out the Depression, then his copyrights, the value of them, the musical copyrights, which were then depressed, would eventually go up.
Well, I'm sure he was right about that.
Yes.
Well, even though he didn't sell out his company, he did do a lot of work for Hollywood.
Yes, oh yes, he did. He was eager to write for films. It took him years to break in, though. He had one flop after another. First, there were songs such as Marie that were used in silence. Then he began writing scores. His first major effort was a movie called Puttin' on the Ritz, which was the centerpiece, of course, was the wonderful song Puttin' on the Ritz. This starred the vaudevillian Harry Richmond. However, it was a terrible movie, and it flopped. It wasn't until Top Hat, with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, his score for that, which contained the fabulous Cheek to Cheek, that he really scored. And no one forgot all the earlier tentative efforts of his. And from then on, his name was gold in Hollywood.
How were Berlin and Astaire put together in a movie?
Well, they were put together by the producer, Pandro S. Berman, who had fabulous taste. He told me that he had been dying to put these two together. And also, Berlin and Astaire had a great deal in common. They had both come up through vaudeville, and they were both highly dedicated and intense perfectionists. So I think the high standards that they set for themselves allowed them to have a very good working relationship.
Well, let's hear one of the really beautiful songs from the movie Top Hat. And this is Cheek to Cheek, sung by Fred Astaire, recorded in 1935. ¶¶
heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak.
Gosh, I love that. you say that Irving Berlin said that he'd rather have Fred Astaire introduce a song than any other singer.
Yes, that's right.
I can certainly understand why.
Well, he loved the way that Astaire kind of combined singing and speaking at the same time. He put a little jaunty hopping rhythm in there, and Berlin felt he had extraordinary sensitivity to his music.
Would you tell the story of how Moss Hart once reacted when he had Irving Berlin demonstrate one of his new songs?
I'd be glad to. This was something that happened to Berlin throughout his career. Like many songwriters, Berlin was a terrible performer. His voice was high. It was reedy. You would have to say this in his favor, though. He had absolutely perfect pitch. However, when he sang one of his songs, they sounded terrible. When he was writing the score for his famous review of called As Thousands Cheer in 1932, from which I took the title of my book, in 1933, rather, he began to sing some of the songs, such as Heat Wave for Moss Hart, who was appalled. Here was the great Irving Berlin, and he was sitting at the piano and singing, and Hart thought the songs sounded tinny, they sounded empty, they sounded like nothing. He got very, very worried. Hart was a worrywart. Finally, he said, "Irving, would you please sing Cheek to Cheek, or All Alone, or several other of his classics?" And Berlin sang the others, and they sounded just as terrible, and Hart found that very reassuring, that he knew he had some hit songs on his hands, as soon as he could get them to real performers.
Well, not only couldn't Berlin sing very well, he wasn't a very convincing pianist either.
Well, no, that was one of the things that intrigued me about him, was the paradox of our nation's greatest and most successful songwriter being unable to read or write music. And I think that that was an astonishing story. He used a couple of ways of getting around this limitation. And one was the use of a musical secretary who took down the notation for him. The other was the use of a prepared piano, which could shift keys at the touch of a lever, which was a fairly common invention when Berlin was a young man. And whenever he did try to take formal music lessons or piano lessons, and he tried several times, it was a disaster. And it made him feel self-conscious and got in the way of his composing. And finally, people would tell him, "Irving, just stick with doing it the way you're doing."
Lawrence Berggren is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. Let's get Irving Berlin back from movies to Broadway. One of Berlin's most famous, most celebrated musicals was the 1946 Annie, Get Your Gun. Berlin wasn't supposed to be the composer who wrote this.
That's right. He was not the first choice. It was Jerome Kern who was supposed to write this. Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were much better known for South Pacific, were then becoming producers as well, and they wanted Kern to write it. Kern somewhat reluctantly came back to New York from Hollywood to begin work on the score, and he suddenly collapsed on the pavement of Manhattan and died several days later. Afterwards, the backers of the show began scrambling for someone else who would be American enough to write the story of this unlettered sharpshooter, and inevitably they settled on Berlin. Of course, Berlin was known not only as a brilliant songwriter, but as a giant ego, and they were afraid they might have to turn over the show lock, stock, and barrel to him, which they weren't prepared to do. Berlin gave ground a little bit and stopped insisting on having his name in the title as Irving Berlin's Annie, Get Your Gun, and to write a traditional score. And it was his most successful score. It was filled with one hit after another. I've Got the Sun in the Morning and the Moon at Night, There's No Business Like Show Business, and six or seven others.
It's amazing in a way that show business' greatest anthem, There's No Business Like Show Business, came from a musical about Annie Oakley.
That's right. We tend to think of that song now as being very bombastic and very self-celebrating, but in the context of the original show where it appeared, there was just a small group of three or four performers who sang it. It was slightly poignant. It was almost a self-parody, and it didn't have that larger-than-life quality that we tend to find intimidating today, and that made it a far more charming song, I think, in its original incarnation.
Why don't we hear it?
The cowboys, the wrestlers, the tumblers, the clowns, the roustabouts that move the show at dawn. The music, the spotlights, the people, the towns, your baggage with the labels pasted on. The sawdust and the horses and the smell. The towel you've taken from the last hotel. There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show.
There's no business like show business. From the cast recording of the 1966 revival of Annie Get Your Gun. Irving Berlin's career kind of headed downwards after this musical, didn't it?
Well, by then he was getting older. Of course, even in his late 50s, he had managed to hang on far longer than most songwriters, who often burned out when they were very young indeed in their 20s. So already he had an extraordinary track record. His songs were still good in Hollywood. He had one or two more successes on Broadway, especially Call Me Madam, which also starred Ethel Merman a few years later. But it's true, then he began losing his self-confidence, losing his touch, and unfortunately the forces which gradually overtook him were beginning to form.
Well, you describe him as something of a reactionary, too, especially in his reaction to Elvis Presley's White Christmas. Why don't you describe his response?
Well, he was horrified by it, and as soon as he had heard it, he sent telegrams around to all the radio stations in the country forbidding them from performing this song. And, of course, he was appalled by the rise of rock and roll and phenomena such as Elvis Presley, not so much on a political basis, but because he saw his livelihood being taken away by a new breed of performer who placed themselves above the song and who had an entirely different audience. Berlin had managed to reinvent himself for several generations throughout the teens, the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, but in the 60s he saw that it was going to be impossible to reinvent himself for the kids, the youth of that time.
Was he bitter about that?
Extremely bitter, yes.
Well, we've only had time to talk about a really small part of Irving Berlin's life and songs, but I thank you very much for bringing that small part to life for us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Terry.
My guest has been Lawrence Berggren, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. It's just been published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue? On that famous thoroughfare, with their noses in the air, high hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The art of David Wojnarowicz has recently been at the center of controversy because the subject matter deals with sexuality and AIDS. Coming up, Wojnarowicz discusses his art, and he explains why he's suing a group that's trying to cut off government funding of the arts. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of works by Irish composer John Field, the man who invented the nocturne. And book critic John Leonard reviews Magic Lantern. It's a first-person account of last year's political events in Europe by scholar and journalist Timothy Garton Ash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A short while ago on Capitol Hill, the U.S. Senate turned down an amendment against flag burning. Even though the vote was 58 to 42 for the measure, this was 9 votes fewer than the 67 needed for a 2/3 majority vote. The vote, though, was largely symbolic, because last week the House turned down the flag-burning amendment, and Speaker Foley said that lawmakers in the House would not get a chance to reconsider this year. President Bush has barred increased oil drilling in a number of U.S. coastal zones. Affected areas include California, southwestern Florida, New England, and the Pacific Northwest. The limited ban on offshore oil and natural gas drilling will last until the next century, while more environmental studies are conducted. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
Oil imports have been rising dramatically, and the administration has been concerned about the U.S. depending too much on foreign supplies. At the same time, the number of oil spills along the coast has also been rising, and with it, public opposition to any new drilling. In making today's announcement, Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan acknowledged the importance of public opinion.
We have had some environmental concerns. There's a new wind blowing, as the president says, and we recognize those concerns.
But many environmentalists say the decision doesn't go far enough, that a moratorium is fine for now, but that real environmental protection requires more than a moratorium on any new drilling, but a strong alternative energy program to wean Americans off petroleum products so the offshore reserves won't ever be needed. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
In northern Iran, 6 days after an earthquake killed at least 36,000 people, over a dozen other survivors are reported to have been found, but foreign rescue workers are getting ready to suspend operations, saying that there is little chance of finding other people alive. Mike Theodulu has more.
Foreign teams are now concentrating on the survivors, a 250,000 still homeless and the tens of thousands injured. But some more people have been rescued from under the rubble. A one-year-old girl was found alive in her bed, her room, by sheer luck, the only one not crushed. And quick thinking saved 6-year-old Sadek. When the first tremors in Thursday's quake toppled over a refrigerator, knocking off the door, he crawled inside, protected as later shocks brought the house down, killing his parents and his 8 brothers and sisters. He was found by a French team. Foreign help has been warmly praised by the Interior Minister, and radical opposition to it is being gradually silenced. One paper urged the hardliners, "For pity's sake, shut up." But it didn't stop a senior politician insisting the late Ayatollah's death order against the British author Salman Rushdie still stands, even though he's pledged money to the disaster fund. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The Dow Jones Industrials closed down 3 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Irish composer and pianist John Field was known for his delicate playing and his dreamy compositions called nocturnes. A new recording of Field's nocturnes has just been released. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the poetic Irish composer has found the perfect interpreter in the poetic Irish pianist John O'Connor.
Rhapsodies and you think of Brahms or Liszt. Think of songs without words and there's only Mendelssohn. Think of the nocturne and you think of Chopin. Nocturnes are usually short, slow, lyrical piano pieces that try to capture the spirit of the night. They were invented, however, not by Chopin, but by the Irish composer and piano virtuoso John Field. Like Chopin, everything Field wrote included a piano. But he was born 28 years before Chopin, in 1782 and died in 1837. He is probably not as well known as he should be because he was so completely overshadowed by his more successful successor. But his nocturnes have a singing, even operatic loveliness, and the best of them, often the ones in a minor key, have an air of searching melancholy. The 10th, an adagio in E minor, has an inner sadness that reminds me of some lost soprano aria that might have been written by Bellini. Here's John O'Connor playing John Field's E minor nocturne. There are a number of explanations for Field's relative neglect. First of all, he falls between two large cultural movements, the classical and the romantic. Field's departure from classicism was not the radical shift that Chopin's was, but he wasn't the romantic classicist that Mendelssohn was either. The simple three-part ABA structure he gave the nocturnes was not especially ambitious or experimental, though there are always imaginative and original touches in the harmony and coloration. His music seldom raises its voice. The liner notes report an anecdote that the first time Field heard Liszt in recital, he turned to his neighbor and asked, "Does he bite?" Field's most successful work seems to be miniaturist. No operas, no symphonies. His 7 piano concertos are seldom performed. One of the nocturnes, however, number 14 in C major, is nearly 10 minutes long and a good deal more varied and complex than the rest. Field is hard to place geographically, too. He came from Ireland, a country without a large-scale international musical tradition. Maybe if he stayed there, he might have become a national hero. But his family moved to London when he was 10. Then, instead of going on to one of the major European musical centers like Paris or Vienna, in 1802 he went to Russia and lived in St. Petersburg and Moscow for nearly 30 years. He married, had a family, and became an alcoholic. For all his many piano compositions, his greatest fame was as a virtuoso performer. Yet the nocturnes don't require a big bravura technique as much as grace and delicacy, with a certain forthrightness to keep them from getting prissy or turning into salon music. O'Connor is just the right pianist. His new album contains 15 of the approximately 18 nocturnes Field wrote, including one that was actually not a nocturne, but a divertissement so sunny that its French publisher called it midi, noon. It's surely the only nocturne in the history of its genre with that title.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. David Wojnarowicz is an artist at the center of the controversy over government funding of the arts. He was represented in last year's group show Witnesses Against Our Vanishing, Art About AIDS. The exhibition was at Artist Space in New York. The National Endowment for the Arts withdrew its funding from the show, then reinstated it, but with the stipulation that no endowment money be used to fund the catalog. The reason was the catalog essay, written by Wojnarowicz, which attacked prominent political and religious figures. Earlier this year, Wojnarowicz had a retrospective exhibition at the Illinois State University Galleries in Normal, funded in part by the NEA. Reverend Donald Wildman is spearheading the attack against the reauthorization of the NEA. One of his recent mass mailings was headlined, "Your tax dollars helped pay for these, quote, works of art." Below were sexually explicit images taken from Wojnarowicz's multimedia works. This week, Wojnarowicz took Wildman to court for violating his copyright and distorting his work by taking it out of context. The judge issued a temporary injunction against the pamphlet. A full decision is expected in a month. Wojnarowicz described how Wildman used his art.
What he did was he excised from the images, small fragments that dealt with sexual activity or depicted sexual activity that were in a political and artistic context, stripped the context from around the image and then presented that image as the full work, put my name on it. And he did this to 14 images, three of which were not sexual in nature, and sent them around the country.
What charges were made about your art in the literature that was sent out with images from your work in it?
Well, it was sent out in an envelope that was marked a warning, extremely offensive materials enclosed or something. I don't have the envelope in front of me, so that's an approximate description of it. What he did was essentially reduce my work by stripping out all the artistic and political context that I place images in. He basically left the very strong impression that my work consists of solely nothing more than a banal pornography.
Now, you're saying that he took one component of a larger mixed media collage work,
right,
and blew that up and presented that as being representative of your work. You've been working with mixed media images,
right,
for a long time. Tell us a little bit about why you work in that form.
I guess emotionally and intellectually, it's the only way that I can represent what my experience in the world is. I mean, I do a lot of things. I write, I make videos, films, performances, paintings, photographs, etc. But the mixed media is, in terms of the paintings is, and some of the photographs, is just about the only way that I can approximate, you know, what it feels like to live in America at this point in time, given that when we walk out in the street, we're so heavily bombarded with visual information, whether it's store signs, newspaper covers, magazine covers, advertising, etc., that I like to use a variety of media that somehow approximates what it's like to walk down a street or to move through space in contemporary America.
One of the issues that brought your work into the center of national controversy was the 1989 group show called Witnesses Against Our Vanishing about the influence of AIDS on aesthetic, sexuality, and culture. This was a group show at a gallery called Artist Space in New York. What was your reaction when, after the NEA reinstated money for the show, it still refused to fund the catalog because of your essay?
Oh, I found it very distressing because it sent out a message. It set a precedent in terms of funding that now single objects can be separated from a show because somebody doesn't like their political content. Two, it sent a message to institutions around the country, publicly funded institutions, that they shouldn't deal with work that might be critical in terms of politics.
Let's talk about how you started making art. Now, you came from a really rough family background. Your father abused your mother. You ended up in an orphanage for a while. Then your father kidnapped you from the orphanage. And you've written that you later threw yourself into sex, and you became a hustler for a while. How did you start making art?
I made things on and off for years since childhood. And by the time I got off the streets, I was living on the streets for a period of time. By the time I got off, when I was about 17 or 18, I had to turn to making things because I basically could never find a place in contact with people to ever express what I had experienced.
Well, how did you get off the streets?
It was pretty complicated. I met an individual in Times Square who had picked me up and who let me live with him in a very small apartment he had on 45th off 8th Avenue. And he was a thief and he was a con man. And he was working in a halfway house for young men coming out of prison as a counselor on falsified psychology degrees. And at some point, he got tired of me living with him, and he asked me if I would like to go to this halfway house where I'd have my own room, et cetera. And so in a very odd, roundabout way, he gave me help.
You must have seen yourself as an outsider from the art world, and I think, in fact, early on in your work, you did a series of pieces that were designed to confront the art world.
Not so much to confront. I think my feelings of whatever I've made has always been to put into a public arena something that was very real to me. Whether it was a series of issues, whether it was a series of images that dealt with reality, as opposed to whatever social code that at times is imposed on reality.
Well, can you describe, though, what some of those early pieces were like? Like, for instance, the piece that you did, was it inside or outside one of Castelli's galleries?
That was an action installation. I did that with an artist, musician, Julie Hare, who was a musician in a band that I was in the late 70s. And we wanted to do a series of what we called action installations, which were basically uninvited installations. And we wanted to open up an idea of what culture was to us as opposed to what was handled by, you know, basically rich white people. And we did an installation dealing with hunger, and we went to Castelli's staircase on Lower Broadway at 12 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday afternoon when the art world is madly rushing around, and we brought a couple of 100 pounds of bloody cow bones from a meat market on 14th Street, dumped them into the staircase, did a painting, a stencil painting with spray paint of a empty plate, a knife and a fork, and then military bombers and houses in flames and figures recoiling on the wall, and then left. And nobody, you know, seemed to think anything was amiss as we were preparing the installation. I mean, I imagine they thought it was just part of the art world.
How did you actually get into the world of galleries in New York?
It was sort of by accident. I was spray painting things in the streets. I was spray painting things on abandoned cars. I lived down around 4th Street and Bowery, and there were there would be car wrecks in the area, or cars would be towed there, disabled cars, and they would sit there for literally years. So I started spray painting images of war on these cars, and they'd be towed overnight. So I found it was a great way to start cleaning up the area that I was living in. And at some point, somebody had seen my work in the streets and met somebody who knew me and asked me to participate in a group show. And I had never really done what I considered paintings. And I went home and I worked on some and gave them to them. And then the gallery asked me if I wanted to have a one-person show. So I did, and it sort of went on from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, a few years ago, your lover died of AIDS, and you have AIDS now. And I wonder if the reality of AIDS has refocused the subject of a lot of your art, the content.
Yes, I would. I mean, I've always painted what I see and what I experience and what I perceive, so it naturally has a place in the work. I think, not all the work I do is about AIDS or deals with AIDS, but I think it's the threads of it are in the other work as well.
Has it been easy for you to work now between problems with your health and all the energy that's been taken up with controversy surrounding your art?
Actually, it makes it difficult to work. And, it's very time-consuming and attention-consuming, so I have found it difficult. I mean, I've managed to continue working on a smaller level, but, I'm hoping that once this trial is out of the way that I can continue.
How's your health?
It's been okay. I mean, it's been up and down.
Since so much of your art is political, do you, in a way, welcome the opportunity to take an even stronger political stand through lawsuits and through having work that becomes the focal point of controversy?
I don't know. I don't welcome that. And I find that being involved in a lawsuit, that it what it's doing is preventing me from continuing working, because all my attention has to go to the issue of this lawsuit and dealing with it. I'm looking forward to this being over with, so I can go back to work and go back to some a fair sense of quietness, etc. I find it very, very disruptive.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Artist David Voinarovich. We contacted the office of Reverend Donald Wildman of the American Family Association. He declined to comment or be interviewed. This is Fresh Air. We have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. We'll hear the latest on Nelson Mandela's visit to America. NPR's John Madison reports on Mandela's address before a joint session of Congress. Vera Frankl reports on the European Economic Community's meeting in Dublin. Leaders there praised South African President F.W. de Klerk, and they hinted that Europe may lift sanctions against South Africa if the reforms continue. In this country, Brian Naylor and Cokie Roberts report on President Bush's softening his election pledge of no new taxes. And Peter Breslau explains why on the beaches of Brazil, they call jogging doing Cooper. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of The Magic Lantern by a journalist who was an eyewitness to many of the most dramatic events in Eastern Europe last year.
Timothy Garton Ash is a serious man, a scholar at Oxford specializing in Middle Europe, a highbrow journalist for periodicals like the New York Review of Books. By accident, he found himself, wherever he went in 1989, somehow on the barricades, at the bottom of a Silesian coal mine, delivering a pro-solidarity speech in Polish, and in Heroes Square in Budapest for a funeral that turned into a resurrection, and in Berlin on a November Sunday when the wall fell down, and most memorably, in a theater in Prague, on a pass stamped personally by Havel, where, without any dress rehearsals, they wrote and performed The Deliverance of Czechoslovakia. There are moments, says Ash, when you feel that somewhere an angel has opened his wings. About such moments, it's impossible to be scholarly and objective. Ash tries, but not very hard. He speaks of something he calls a revolution, a combination of reform and revolution, conducted as much in the media as on the streets, a mixture of popular interest and elite negotiation, in which prisoners became prime ministers and prime ministers became prisoners. He refers to 1789 in France, 1917 in Russia, and 1848, the springtime of nations. He knows perfectly well there's hard work and deep trouble ahead. Smashed economies, polluted environments, ethnic tensions between Magyars and Romanians, Germans and Poles, Czech versus Slovak, the Muslims, the Gypsies, and the Jews. It's as if Stalinism, the ideology and the architecture and the secret police, had sat for 44 years on these countries like a glacier. After the thaw, after what might almost be called the decolonization, all the old reptilian grudges are just itching to resume. But in this lovely, breathless book, Ash is a fan, not an historian. In Warsaw, on election day, some voters came directly from their children's first communion, trailing little girls in long white dresses, the first communion and the first election. In Budapest, a wizened survivor tells him, "I'm happy to have lived to see the end of this disaster, but I want to die before the beginning of the next one." And in Prague, well, you had to be there. Imagine a revolution that's swift, almost entirely nonviolent, joyful, and funny. Havel and his Civic Forum friends met at a theater, the Magic Lantern, on the set for a Dürrenmatt play called Minotaurus. Under a television turned to an operetta with the sound off, they wrote their demands. Their daily performance was a press conference. Once, when they were tired and depressed, students appeared on stage dressed comically as young pioneers, white blouses, red bows, the girls' hair in pigtails. "It is the committee for a more joyful present. We have come," they say, "to cheer you up and to make sure you don't turn into another Politburo." Then they hand out little circular mirrors to each member of the plenum. But all of Prague was a theater. In Wenceslas Square, 300,000 people took the keys out of their pockets and rattled them like wind chimes, like massed Chinese bells. Clearly something suprarational was happening. Hegel's Weltgeist, said some. Agnes of Bohemia, said others. For himself, says Ash, "I'll stick with the angels." So will this reviewer, because Ash was one of those angels, beside himself and jumping for joy.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Magic Lantern by Timothy Garton Ash. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock, with assistance from Allison Dufty. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, obscenity, art, rap, and the First Amendment, with constitutional lawyer David Cole. Also, architect Andres Duany tells us where we went wrong with the suburbs and how we can make them livable again. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.